The Unlovely Truth discusses subjects that may be upsetting to young or sensitive listeners. Please use discretion. In the decades since the Slocum Massacre, which we discussed in episode 11, many have addressed the effects it has had on that part of Texas. It's been argued whether it was indeed a massacre, or to quote some, just an unpleasant situation. One thing is for sure, that event has had a lasting impact on the town of Slocum, the descendants of the victims, and the descendants of the accused. Welcome to episode 12 of The Unlovely Truth. On our last episode, we discussed potential causes of the massacre of African Americans in those last days of July 1910. Some said that a black businessman was cheating a white farmer over a debt, and the tensions between them spilled into the community at large. Others maintain that white anger over the appointment of a black man to supervise white workers in a road project started the violence. And some of the whites in town were responding in fear to rumors that the black community was organizing to kill all of the town's white citizens. Some survivors recounted tales of being ambushed by mobs of white men. Many who were killed would be buried in hastily dug mass graves by their killers, further obscuring the true number of victims. At the age of 78, one survivor shared how her family had been warned by a group of white men who came to their house and told them that all black men in Slocum had better leave or be killed. Many did, taking their families and whatever possessions they could gather quickly. Most never returned. During the American Civil War, Abraham Lincoln said, "Human nature will not change. In any future great national trial, compared with the men of this, we shall be as weak and as strong, as silly and as wise, as bad and as good. Let us therefore study the incidents in this as philosophy to learn wisdom from, and none of them as wrongs to be avenged." As far as I am concerned, when histories of the area are written, they should include the details of the Slocum Massacre for newer generations to learn from. But sadly, that hasn't happened. Massacres where the victims were white and Native Americans were the aggressors are included in Slocum's local histories. But this massacre generally has not been described in depth, where it has been described at all. In the 1980s, a local family tried to donate a plot of land to the city if the local historical commission would place a marker to commemorate those who lost their lives in those terrible few days in July 1910. The commission refused the gift of land if they had to put the commemorative plaque on it. For months, Dr. Granville Hayes, whose family owned the land in question, wrote letters to anyone he thought could help him get this plaque put up. The town was getting ready for a grand celebration of its 150th anniversary. Perhaps the resistance was because no one wanted to put a damper on the party. Or maybe it was because the chairwoman of the commission who turned Dr. Granville down was the author of a soon-to-be-released book covering the history of the town. Her book did not make any mention of the Slocum Massacre either. The families of the members of the mob weren't without their tragedies. In one of his many letters written to try to get a monument to remember the victims, Dr. Granville told this story. The father of one of his childhood friends had ridden with that mob. He described the father as being a fine and religious man who, when he found out that the story that African Americans were plotting to kill all of Slocum's whites was not true, he was so racked with guilt and remorse that he committed suicide. Others told stories of men chasing small children down and shooting them as they ran. Imagine living with that as a part of your family's history. Crimes like these, and really any crimes at all, always leave a lot of victims in their wake. A mob, by definition, is a large group of people intent on causing trouble or violence. Let's all be sure we learned something from this book about what can happen when we let the fear of other people, for whatever reason, in whatever situation, take hold of us. When Pontius Pilate washed his hands and told the mob that they were responsible for whatever happened to Jesus, even though he had said that Jesus had done nothing to deserve death, he participated in Jesus' death by default. He bowed to the mob, and in doing so, allowed them to have their way. I do believe that by refusing to acknowledge such an important instrument in its own history, the town of Slocum is still letting their mob rule to this day.
I'm so excited to welcome back Jill McCracken, our guest from last week. We're going to talk some more about the massacre in Slocum, Texas. Last week, we really kind of went through the timeline of the events. And this week, talking more about the aftermath. Once something like this has happened, the community and to an extent, the nation, as far as they're made aware, are never really the same.
No.
And so, you know, we had so many factors at work here. The complicity of the local government, you know, they identified, I think, maybe 10 perpetrators. They were only able to indict 6 or 7. And then various excuses of, well, the district attorney left and then a new governor was elected. And with all this, nobody ever really got around to prosecuting it. And so these people were given bail and let go. Mm-hmm. And then it was all allowed to just, blow in the wind.
Yep. It was just too difficult. All the bureaucracy got in the way. It's just, you know, we didn't really want to do it anyway. So we didn't have the will to do it.
Right. Because when the people who are the perpetrators are more closely aligned with the people in power, again, what we talked about last week, you've got sameness and otherness. And when the people who are the ones who are supposed to hold the perpetrators accountable, those have the sameness and the victims are the others, it's so easy to just let it slide and forget that it ever happened. And
it's a terrible thing. So it is something that you want to put out of your memory. You want to slam the door on that. You want to make it go away. Say, oh, that's just distasteful. Never mind.
And as a historian and teacher yourself, I know you have examples of this when a little bit of bad behavior, if you can even call this just that, when that slides by and there's no accountability, then it emboldens people to take the next step and the next step and the next step, which I'm sure in your Holocaust studies,
oh, yeah,
you have a lot of examples of that. So, you know, talk to us about that.
Well, it never happens in a vacuum. I mean, you might have a psychotic individual who goes on a rage with a knife or something, but collective behavior like this does not happen in a vacuum. There's usually the steps of beginning to have the others identified. You don't know them because they're others and you keep them at a distance. And what we don't understand, we fear. We don't know what they're doing. We don't know why they're laughing. We don't know what goes on in their houses, in their churches, how they conduct their businesses. And if you're thinking of them as a little bit less than human, they're not quite equal, then they're even scarier because they're not equal with you. And if you have that perspective going on, they become very fearsome creatures.
Well, and I think, you know, we see in modern day times that the media can, for good or for ill, really influence how people see people that aren't just like them.
Absolutely.
And especially if you have, in a lot of the countries you have experience with, if you have a state-run media, the state is going to put out there what it wants you to think.
The group that I observe with is OSCE, and there is a whole group that investigates the media. in an election. How are commercials presented? Radio, television, social media. It is all investigated to see how much money is being funneled in. And are these medias now becoming more independent? And if they become independent, is there retaliation if they were over-promoting a minority candidacy versus the guy who had been in power previously? You know, are there shenanigans like that going on? And they investigate all that. You also have to be invited into the country. So there is also has to be, while you might be critical, a mutual respect going on. So it never gets down and dirty and ugly, because you are looking to help improve. It's not so much about criticism and that harshness that you might be used to. In the United States, we are very harsh. We tear each other apart. And this is not for that purpose. I really want to make that distinction. That we're looking to build up, not tear down, when we do these missions.
And I'll get on my soapbox for just a minute.
Oh, please do.
I think that I really want to encourage people, you know, don't avoid the media, but just be wise, be discerning. Look at more than one viewpoint. Don't get your favorite little news outlet, and that's the only one that you ever listen to or read anything by. See what the other side is saying and try to make your own decisions about what you think is going on.
Do you mean we should understand the other?
I think
we should.
I think it could help. Yes, I do.
I do think it could. Yeah, that's one thing. As a teacher, I always had to teach about the others, whether I was teaching the Civil War and had to know about the South and the North, or World War II and had to say this is what the Allies versus the Axis were doing. Always had to teach both sides of things. And that's a neat trick to sit here and be able to articulate what you believe in and what you don't believe in accurately. Accurately.
Well, and what's the old saw? The winners get to write the history?
They absolutely do.
But that doesn't mean they're writing the truth.
No.
So, yeah, definitely people.
That's why I say read the reports, read the primary sources, read the diaries yourself.
Oh, of course. And, you know, at the bottom of all this, once you take the layer of, you know, government control or ignoring a situation, media potential manipulation, to me, what this book came down to was the families, the individuals, the people that were affected. They were never, ever, ever the same. You had almost a mini diaspora, to take a term from the Holocaust, where the families that survived were so frightened, so intimidated, that they left homes that they owned, they left businesses they built up, they left acreage that they farmed, just left it all to get away, to be safe. And they never went back to claim it ever again. So the entire makeup of that region was altered.
Changed.
And even the survivors on the side of the people that were the perpetrators, their children had to live with what their families had done. And so, you know, you talked about things not existing in a vacuum. Crime never does either.
No.
There are primary victims, but there's all kinds of secondary victims. And then changes to the culture at large, where people that don't even realize what happened there are still affected by it. And I think that sometimes there's this historical ignorance. You know, I certainly had never heard of the Slocum Massacre ever.
No.
And a friend recommended this book. And so, you know, as a teacher, as a historian, as someone who has been to other countries to, as you said, bear witness to how things are done there, what would you say to people about not falling into this trap of historical ignorance?
Tolerance. It all comes down to tolerance. We are blessed to live in this country of so many millions and millions of people who are all different shades, colors, religions, and creeds. The rest of the world is not like that. I'll give you an example. It's going to be so simplistic and you'll probably think I'm crazy, but we just passed President's Weekend and we celebrate Washington and Lincoln. When are their birth dates? They're on President's Weekend. The date isn't really important to Americans. 4th of July is important, but, you know, we kind of fudge it because we want to have a holiday.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, I got to have that 3-day weekend whenever right. you can.
That's not how it is in the rest of the world. They're very locked in on the date an event happened. And it might be a cultural date, a religious date, the date of a battle, the date of a war, the date of a birth date. And that tolerance, I don't mean to be condemning the rest of the world either. It's just a cultural difference. But that tolerance can be much more difficult to embrace. I was talked last time I spoke about Kosovo.
Mm-hmm.
And some, just a quick example of what I'm trying to convey. They were part of Serbia for hundreds upon hundreds of years. And yet they were always Albanians. They'd never be Serbs. Never.
Interesting.
In America, we very quickly come here and become Americans.
Oh, I love how, you know, people keep their heritage, the identity
yes.
of where they were from and what made them who they are. Yet at the same time, what we all are is Americans.
Right. We become Americans. That doesn't happen elsewhere. It really, really doesn't. And right. that is such a unique, special gift here. But because we have that, we must keep our eyes open to our own history.
Mm-hmm.
It is a wonderful history. I love teaching American history. But we've had some serious missteps. And from understanding that, we have built a better future. And we will continue to do so. But you have to look at yourself honestly. Don't have historical ignorance. Know where we came from. Understand what happened in East Texas. Remember right. that. And improve. Improve upon it. And it's tolerance.
It amazed me that over 100 years later, after this had happened, they were still fighting to get a historical marker put up. The powers that be in the area didn't particularly want to highlight this portion of their history, which is understandable because it was so unfortunate. But at the same time, you know, again, the old saw of if you don't learn from history, you're doomed to repeat it. And that reminded me of in Exodus, you know, Moses built an altar to remember where God made the covenant with Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the Israelites were going to the promised land, they were told to take stones from the River Jordan to build a memorial.
Mm-hmm.
And I love what one of the reasons for it was. It said it's so that future generations will ask what the memorial means. God didn't want us to forget these things. He wanted us to teach our children and to carry on that legacy. Mm-hmm. And I think you can take a negative event and make a positive legacy out of it if you use it as this marker, this memorial to tell people we can't ever let this happen again. So
That's why we have dialogue. That is why we have the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. Museum to something that happened on the other side of the world.
Right.
Because we became involved in that when our liberators got there. Talk about PTSD. The survivors had it in spades. But when our liberators got there, they were hit with something so horrific that we now became very much a part of that story as liberators. And well, no, that should never be allowed to happen again. And yet we do let it happen again.
How wonderful, though, that there were people with foresight that yes. said, take the pictures, make the movies, write the stories. Because yes. someday
there will be deniers.
There will be deniers. And the people who were there and could testify will be gone.
Mm-hmm.
And we're getting very close to that that point in history.
They are. I have a mezuzah on my door in every home that I have lived in the last 40 years. And people often say, but you're Catholic. And I said, yes, I said, I am Catholic. I said, but I do have a mezuzah on my door. And that is to remember the people that have no one to remember them.
Oh, what a beautiful, beautiful way to say that.
I remember them.
That's why we have to have the history classes.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we have to have the books like this, so that we don't forget. Because like you said, we like to think that that part of our past is over.
We have to train and we have to teach each generation, because we have to circumvent that hot wiring in the brain to not be so skittish about the us versus them. We have to teach us. That song from South Pacific, you have to be taught to hate and fear. It's true. It really is that you have to overcome that. It's very easy to fall into that. And very easy, we've talked about economics, how to blame other people. And, he got my promotion.
Well, I think for me, one of the most disturbing parts of this book, and I've seen it in other historical books, they did have some historical photographs of lynchings.
Ugh.
And as horrific as seeing the body of someone who was killed out of hate and spite and not allowed due process of law, the more disturbing part of the pictures to me is to look at the crowd and see the smiling faces, see the young children people have brought to witness this.
Yeah. Like you're at a day at a picnic.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know,
come out and see the event.
You know, it's like the Middle Ages where, you know, public hangings and everything, like you said, were social events.
Yeah.
And, you know, today we try to be a little more slick about it, but I think, you know, our obsession with seeing everything we can on the internet, whether it's video or photographs, there's a place for having those to make sure there can't be deniers. But I think sometimes we can get a little too involved with that. And again, forget that these victims were actually people. They were brothers and sons and sisters and cousins and friends and dads and moms, and they mattered to people.
Yes. There's proof, but then there's proof. You still have to remain utmost dignity and respect for these people, and you shouldn't be using them for more than the immediate need. That's it. There is a hard line there for me. Hard line.
You mentioned the Holocaust Museum in Washington, and I was going to bring that up to you. I wonder what museums of the same type that you visited in other countries, and what kind of differences do you see in how they memorialize things versus how we do?
There are a large number of, sadly, there are a large number of these museums now. I've spent an enormous amount of time at the museum in DC. I did a Mandel fellowship with them and been through multiple training courses. And if I ever wind up living in DC, I would be a docent for them in a flat minute. I would do it. I have been to the memorial in Germany, which is so incredibly different. It was inspired by a cornfield and the idea of a person being trapped and running through this field and not being able to find their way out. So when you go to Berlin, you see these very large marble slabs of varying sizes and shapes. They're very tall. And it's like a maze of these blocks, and you can walk through them. And it does feel like this endless maze and that sense of hopelessness of not being able to get out. but a very, very different memorial than you might think. I was in Poland, and, you know, I have to tell you, here they're trying so hard to get a placard to memorialize this one event that took place in Slocum. And in Poland, there's a marker on every tree, corner, house, wall. I mean, you can't get away from it because it was just so vast of everything that was happening in Poland. And the memorials, the art, the different shapes, people, the anguish carved into their faces, mm-hmm. adults leading children, you know, and you know where they're going. They're going to their deaths. It's just incredible. I was in the ghetto fighters kibbutz, and that, you know, is just defiance. Everything you see there is strength and defiance because it's the ghetto fighters who resisted the Nazis for like a month when they were supposed to just go down and they were going to have a ghetto was Judenfree. That is, there'd be no Jews in the ghetto for Hitler's birthday. And it didn't work out that way. Wow. Just, you know, everyone is so incredibly different and is on a different level, appealing to a different sense. But the communities and the countries, they reflect their national consciousness. In Amsterdam, I was at both a synagogue and a memorial. And, you know, necessarily think of Amsterdam as the heart of Jewishness, but it had a very large Jewish community. And they had pictures, and they had pictures of the different families and family names on the walls with, an endless candle that would just continue.
Oh, wow.
And just so powerful.
How moving.
Yad Vashem in Jerusalem and Yaleel, which is the memorial for the children that were lost, two incredibly powerful museums. There's the Valley of the Communities, which is this red stone. It looks like Sedona, if you've ever been to Sedona, but it's mm-hmm. that red stone. And then as you go through this, almost like a cavern, on each turn, they have the names of the lost communities that were just empty. These people were all gone. And it goes on and on and on and on. And you're winding your way through this maze. It's overwhelming. But every community, every nation, it just reflects what their need was to express. And I think ours in DC does a phenomenal job.
Well, and there is a newer memorial. And I'm trying to look up exactly where it is. It's in the South. The Equal Justice Initiative, which was founded by Brian Stevenson, who was the author of the book from podcast episode number one, Just Mercy. They have opened the National Memorial for Peace and Justice. And part of that is dedicated to victims of lynching throughout the South. And they collected soil, and they have it in jars from the scenes of these lynchings. And I just, what a simple yet powerful symbol of, you know, that really, again, it gets into the soil of that community.
Well, what I thought when you said that, the way that struck me, was where do we all return to? All of us.
Oh, excellent. Yeah.
It hits everybody differently, and that's how it hit me. We all return here.
Wow.
And here, these people returned way too soon. They returned way too soon, but we all, it's something that we all have in common.
Yeah. It's in Montgomery, Alabama, and I'm hoping to get there sometime soon and see.
Let me know when you go. Road trip.
There we go.
Road trip.
We can do some remote recording for each of our podcasts there. And I think that these types of places are so important. You know, parents, I encourage you to to expose your children to these things and these ideas, and let them ask questions and answer them as honestly as you can. Because we're not going to be able to stop this from happening again if we don't remember how horrific it was when it has happened in the past.
And we have come a long way.
True. Understand. Very true.
We have our difficulties without question, but it's not 1742. It's not 1862. We have come and improved.
Yes.
And we have foundation to build on. We do. We have foundation to build on. We can do it.
Because we have wonderful people who start and maintain these facilities, and they don't happen all by themselves. So kudos to everyone who has donated, who's volunteered time, who's just visited and allowed what's created to help shape them.
Yeah.
Well, thanks again for another wonderful episode. You've been a great guest, and I'm so excited to share your experiences with everybody. And again, in case you missed it last week, want to make sure that you know that Jill has her own podcast, Murder Shelf Book Club, and it is a hoot. She and her co-host, I love the banter. If you just want to feel like you're sitting around with friends. At a book club, talking about true crime, because, I think there's a lot of closet fans. Because I started out mine and said, you don't exactly go to your church friends and say, who wants to talk about murder with me? It gets a little awkward. So just know that you're in good company. There are good podcasts out there that that educate and entertain, but at the same time have a healthy respect for victims and their families. And congratulations that you fall in that category.
That's really important to us.
Good. And it is me as well.
With class and dignity.
That's right. So thanks again, everybody. Go look up Murder Shelf Book Club on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, Google Play. If it plays podcasts, you can probably find it there. So make
Absolutely.
Sure you do that. Thanks again, Jill.
Oh, you've been thank you awesome. So much.
It was great talking to you.
You too, hon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.
The Unlovely Truth is written and produced by me, Lori Morrison. Music is by Neil Cortex, and the artwork is by Shelby Morrison. Thanks to my special guest, Jill McCracken. As always, my biggest thanks are to you, the listeners. Please help the podcast continue to grow by downloading and sharing it with your friends. You can find it on iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher, Spotify, and other places where your favorite podcasts are found. And please check out my website at theunlovelytruth.com. You can find resources and sign up to get email reminders when a new episode drops. You can also find information about the podcast on Facebook and Instagram, so be sure to check that out. See you next time.